No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you're welcome to call in and be part of the show. Ask questions if you like at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your comments to BBSRADIOPR. Maria is not with us tonight. She's off in London doing research. Supposedly doing research. She may be gallivanting around. Who knows? I hope she's having a good time. But she'll be back next week. And next week, I'm going to take a week off, which is very unusual, because I'll be presenting for the fourth time before the National Conference of Social Studies in Austin, Texas. I'm doing a presentation on statehood before social studies teachers from all across the country. But we're very excited. I'm very excited tonight to have a friend and a really important player in our world here in Washington, D.C., especially when it comes to voting rights and statehood, and that's Attorney Walter Smith. Walter has been the executive director of a public interest group called D.C. Appleseed since 2001. He previously served as a special deputy corporation counsel in what is now the Attorney General's office, and among other things, he supervised litigation affecting the school system, setting up pro bono assistance for the district from private law firms, and bringing a suit before a three-panel federal court to give the district voting representation in Congress. He practiced for 16 years at the law firm of Hogan Lovells, where he specialized in appellate litigation. For several years, he served as a partner and full-time director of the firm's pro bono practice. He also served as a lieutenant in the United States Navy, JAG Corps. He has argued numerous cases before the Supreme Court and the U.S. Court of Appeals. And in 2011, he received the President's Award from the Washington Council of Lawyers. And in 2007, the Legal Times named him one of the 90 greatest lawyers of the past 30 years. And let me tell you something, that is quite an accolade in Washington, D.C., where you cannot spit, as they say, without hitting a lawyer. We have lots of lawyers here, and Walter is certainly one of the very best. So welcome to the show. Walter, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can we talk for just a minute? Can we start out by talking about your previous lawsuit before the federal court and what happened there, and okay, and you know, and how this has led you to a new lawsuit? Can you explain that to our listeners, please?
Sure. So when I was the special deputy corporation counsel for the city, we engaged a number of pro bono lawyers at Covington and Burling and others to help us bring what was the first lawsuit in the federal court, arguing that we are constitutionally entitled to voting representation in the Congress. But at that time, we were forced to argue that we needed to be treated as if we were state residents under the Constitution. The Constitution in Article 1 gives voting representation to residents of states. And we said that we think the framers intended to treat us as residents of states f- for purposes of voting. The court disagreed with us in a 2-1 decision over a very strong dissent. But the court also said it was sympathetic to our situation, but that the court couldn't give us relief. We needed to seek relief from the Congress. And just to continue the story for you, Senator Brown, we accepted the court's invitation to go to the Congress, and we presented our case to the Congress, and eventually, and I know you know this story, both houses of Congress, both the House and the Senate, agreed with us that we were entitled to voting representation, at least in the House. They passed a bill in both houses giving us the vote in the House, and the important thing about that was that they agreed that they had the authority to do that under a different provision of the Constitution, which you and I call the District Clause. This is the clause of the Constitution that gives the Congress absolute authority over the nation's capital. And what was great about them agreeing to that was it meant that we didn't have to agree on the provision of the Constitution that gives the vote only to residents of states. Now, you know the rest of the story was that even though both houses agreed with us that they could give us the vote, eventually that bill died because a senator added an amendment to the bill that provided that all of the district's gun safety laws would be repealed and that the Council of the District of Columbia could never pass another gun safety law. And the elected leaders here in the district decided that price was too high, that public safety had to take precedence, at least at that time, and they withdrew the bill. The great news about all of that, and you know then this is Chapter 3 after the first lawsuit and going to the Congress, once the Congress agreed that it could simply pass a law giving us the vote, that gave us the grounds for a new lawsuit. And so, as you know, the next chapter is we have brought a new lawsuit saying, now that you've agreed you can simply pass a law giving us the vote, it's unconstitutional that you haven't done it.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, I went through that whole thing with the D.C. Voting Rights Act with you and all the other activists that were there. And yeah, and it was a lovely man from Nevada, Senator Ensign, who torpedoed the whole thing through, who later, by the way, left Congress in disgrace. Who torpedoed the thing. And I'm not a lawyer, Walter, but I've never for the life of me being able to understand why we're not protected under things like the 14th Amendment, why we don't have equal protection, why we don't, you know, why this simple clause in Article 1 that says the Congress shall have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever allows them to usurp our right as citizens to participate in government. Why is that clause superior to all the other clauses that protect the rights of citizens?
Well, originally in the first lawsuit, the court said that because Article 1, Section 2 gives the vote to people in states, and the district is not a state, the court said that the Equal Protection Clause couldn't override that limitation. But that was before the Congress later said, we don't have to rely on Article 1, Section 2. Congress said we can rely on what's called the District Clause, which is in Article 1, Section 8, as right. You know. And that was the big breakthrough. Once the Congress agreed that they could simply pass a law giving us the vote, because up till then people had said it took a constitutional amendment, but once the Congress agreed they could simply pass a law giving us the vote, then we didn't have to rely on arguing we had to be treated as residents of states. Now, given the Equal Protection Clause and the fact that under the Equal Protection Clause, the right to vote is fundamental. In fact, the Supreme Court has said It's the right upon which all other rights turn.
Right.
Now the failure of Congress to exercise its authority under the District Clause, we say, is itself unconstitutional, which means that we're now a step beyond that first lawsuit. But the thing is, we had to go through the first lawsuit and then through the Congress agreeing they could just give us the vote. So now we're ready to say to a new three-judge court, now it's time to hold that it violates our fundamental rights under equal protection that they haven't given us the vote, and the court should declare that it's unconstitutional.
Well, let me ask you, we have another person who's come to me, and actually we've been to a couple of law firms with this idea, which I don't fully understand, but I would like to get your opinion. And he says his opinion is that it was okay for Congress to it was okay for Maryland and Virginia to give land to Congress for the nation's capital, but they can't give the people who are actually still Maryland citizens, technically, they couldn't give the people to Congress. And jurisdiction over the land is one thing and jurisdiction over the people is another. And he thinks that's grounds for a lawsuit. What do you think of that idea?
Well, once Maryland and Virginia ceded land, and you're referring to the fact that the District of Columbia was created out of land that was once part of Maryland and Virginia. Once that land had been ceded to the Congress, to the United States, then the United States had complete and full authority over that land that became the nation's capital. And although, and I know you know this, in the first lawsuit, we tried to argue that the people who now live in the district had residual rights,
right,
going back to when they were residents of Maryland. But the court rejected that. The court rejected that, and the Supreme Court summarily affirmed. So we've lost that argument. I mean, I think that was a good argument when we made it,
right. But
the court rejected it 2-1. But I actually think, Senator, that the arguments we're making now in this lawsuit are stronger than the arguments we made in the first lawsuit. And I actually think we have a very good chance of winning it this time.
Wow, that would be great. And I got to tell you, you know that you and I have talked privately, Walter, and I sometimes have a problem with things that I think are a distraction. Now, I know for a fact, because I'm a student of the Civil Rights Movement, that in the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, the activists were everywhere. They were in the courts, they were on the streets, they were, they were on the media, they were everywhere. So I do believe in a strategy of always being in court, always being out there protesting, always trying to get as much press and publicity as we can for our issue. Tell me, what do you think, where do you stand on this lawsuit right now? How are things going? And what do you think about the idea that it's a distraction? Do you see it as a distraction, or do you path forward?
I think it's part of us doing all the things you're saying. I think that we're smart to be in the courts and be in the streets and be in the media and be in the halls of Congress and be out in the other state legislatures, which is one of the things I know you've been doing. I think the more tools we use and the more visibility we bring to our lack of full democracy, the more apt eventually to get this problem fixed and do justice to people who live here. Now, let me tell you where the lawsuit is right now, because I think that's one of the things you're asking.
Yes.
We brought this lawsuit last November, the day before the midterm elections. And the reason we did that and timed it that way was because we were hopeful that in the midterms that the Democrats would retake the House. And that is exactly what happened. And we visited with some of our friends on the Hill, including Eleanor Holmes Norton. And we urged Mrs. Norton, and through her, we urged the leadership in the House to get the Democrats to bring the House of Representatives into the lawsuit on our side. And that's one of the things that makes me optimistic that we have a real good chance to win this lawsuit.
I don't want to interrupt you, but do you feel that that's what's been done with H.R. 1, for example? Do you think that's what motivated them in H.R. 1 to include the district?
Oh, sure. I do. I think this is all part of what I would call a 1-2 punch right now. There is this serious movement on the Hill to bring us statehood, which would give us the vote. But there's a serious movement in the federal courts also to give us the vote. And I think the two of them work together. I think they reinforce and complement one another. And, of course, as it turns out, as a matter of timing, that we may well move in the courts before the full Congress moves on the statehood bill. I don't know for sure. But I think having two shots at this simultaneously is good for us. And I want your listeners to know that it took us about a year to get the case fully briefed because, of course, the Department of Justice opposed us on behalf of the President and the Senate. But the House of Representatives supported us. So all of these different groups and individuals have filed briefs. And in addition to that, a number of what we call amicus briefs, that is outside parties who want to be a friend of the court, file their own briefs. So we had a number of historians and a number of constitutional law experts, a number of voting rights organizations, all to file in our support, and the court, and there are three judges, so it's what we call a three-judge federal court. They have scheduled argument in the case for a week from Tuesday. The oral argument in the case will be at the federal courthouse here in Washington, D.C., Tuesday morning at 10:30. And our lawyers who are arguing in behalf of plaintiff residents will get a chance to have their say, and the counsel for the House of Representatives will be arguing on our side, and then a lawyer from the Department of Justice will be arguing in opposition. And there are three federal judges who will hear this case. The way a three-judge court works is one of the judges is a federal appellate judge, and that's Robert Wilkins. He is a federal judge, sits on the D.C. Circuit, and then there are two district judges, Randy Moss and Trevor McFadden. And there'll be 40 minutes to the side, and if the court is really interested and wants to hear more, they may listen a little longer. But my guess is this will go roughly from 10:30 in the morning until noon.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, you know, it's just unbelievable to me that, you know, we're the only country in the world that does this. And you know, how can this possibly be right? Is your lawsuit, would your lawsuit, if you prevail, would we ultimately get representation in both houses of Congress?
That's what the lawsuit argues.
Yeah.
Because the reasons that we say we're constitutionally entitled to voting representation at this point apply equally to the House and the Senate. And the Department of Justice has not disagreed with that. They have not said, well, there's one rule for one House and another rule for the other. So I believe that if we win, we will win across the board. And what we're asking the court for is what lawyers call a declaratory judgment, which is a fancy way of saying, please write an opinion saying that we're entitled to win under the Constitution. That will be the first step. If the court issues that judgment in our favor, then it will be left to the Congress to determine exactly how it's going to grant us this relief. And interestingly, Senator, we pointed out in our lawsuit that one way that the Congress could rule for us is, of course, simply to pass a bill giving us two senators and one representative. But another way it could be done is for the Congress simply to pass the pending statehood bill.
Right.
So we will see how this plays out. I do think that if the court rules in our favor, there's a possibility, of course, that the Department of Justice, on behalf of the President and or the Senate, will appeal to the Supreme Court. The interesting thing about this lawsuit, and one of the reasons we asked for a three-judge court, is that usually when you bring a lawsuit in federal court, you have to go through three different levels. First, you're in the district court, then you're in the Court of Appeals, and then you try to get to the Supreme Court. But in a three-judge court case like this, where even though we brought it originally in the district court, we asked for the court to convene three judges, and they agreed to do that. That means this case will go directly from this three-judge court to the Supreme Court. So it will move much more quickly than other lawsuits usually do.
Well, let me ask you, if you prevail in the case and it's handed over to Congress to resolve the issue, can they resolve it by giving us a vote in the House and not giving us a vote in the Senate? No, they can't do that.
No,
okay.
They can't.
Because that was always a problem with the first.
It was. So this is a better lawsuit. It's a stronger mm-hmm. lawsuit, and it seeks much, much broader relief. There's no guarantee here. I mean, we will see how this court responds, and a week from Tuesday, we're going to have some indication, I think, of how the judges are leaning. I mean, you and I have been in a lot of court arguments, and people go in and they try to read tea leaves. Sometimes you don't know how the court is leaning, but sometimes you do. And I look for this is a very smart panel, and I look for them to be very well prepared. And I'm sort of hoping that we'll get some indication by the give and take during the argument about how they're leaning.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that I very often use this analogy of my daughter's soccer team when she was little. You know, they start them playing soccer when they're babies, like 4 or 5 years old. And she had a little boy on her team who actually went on to be a star college soccer player. But at the time, he understood that if he kicked the ball enough, it would go in. And that's all he did. He kicked the ball, it went out of bounds, it went here, it went there. But he always scored the most goals because he just kept on kicking. And I really, truly believe that that's what we need to do. We need to keep on kicking the ball until we finally get it across the into the goal. And I also believe, I know there are people out there that don't want anything but statehood, and I'm really one of those people. But I believe also that if we were to get representation in both houses, all the other rights that we lack would soon follow. I'm sure that we would get control over our budget, control over our legal system, you know, all those things I think would quickly follow. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think that if we win this lawsuit but have not yet achieved passage of the statehood bill, winning the lawsuit makes the passage of the bill much more likely. Just the way the democratic process works in Congress.
Right.
If for the first time we at last have two senators.
Yes.
And now we have none, that is voting senators. I think that the vote trading that goes on and the respect that senators give one another, you know, you mm-hmm. vote for me on this, it matters in my jurisdiction, I'll vote for you in yours, I think will improve the chances of us getting there.
Well, and I must tell you, this is one of the many reasons that I have respect for Eleanor Holmes Norton, is that she's done so much for us in the District of Columbia without anything to trade. And you know, and you're right, that's exactly how it works up there. And I also think that just the threat of statehood helps us. You and I have talked about this in the past, that in negotiations, you know, you don't go in and negotiate at the lowest level. You push for what you want, and maybe you settle for something that's not exactly what you want, but you always push for that. And I remember that Jack Kemp, and you may remember this too, Jack Kemp, who was a strong Republican, supported the D.C. Voting Rights Act, and he sat down with me one day and told me that's exactly why he did it. He supported it because he didn't want to see the district have representation in the Senate. And he said, if we give you representation in the House, you know, I feel that that's what you deserve and that's just. But it was almost a fear that we would get more than he was willing to give that made him amenable to give us what we were asking for.
Right.
So I think
right.
that's an important strategy.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. And you probably remember that when the voting rights bill, the last one, was pending and wouldn't have moved as far as it did without the support of Congressman Tom Davis, who
right.
partnered with Eleanor Holmes Norton. Tom Davis also was not in favor of us having two senators. And you probably also remember that the reason that so many senators, at least on the Republican side at the time, tried to find some way to stop the bill that would have given us only the vote in the House was that they were fearful that once we achieved the vote in the House, we would then be moving on and would get the vote in the Senate. So they wanted to nip the thing in the bud. I understand
right.
that kind of thinking.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the truth. And I really think, you know, again, back to Eleanor Holmes Norton, that she's so effective. She's been so effective. And, you know, we call her our warrior on the Hill because she has worked so hard and been so effective that I really always had that impression that they weren't so much against giving Eleanor Holmes Norton a vote as they were against getting two senators. You know, I think if we all got together and promised that we would, you know, some way that we could do it legally, promise that we wouldn't go any further, that it would have been much easier for us to get a vote in the House. I really believe
that they
would do that.
On the other hand, Senator, and I know you've heard Mrs. Norton say this, she could have more impact in the House if we also had two voting senators.
Of course.
Because she would then have more influence.
Of course. Of course. And you know, and this is a travesty for us, right? We talk about all the different things, encumbrances that flow from this Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution are not being able to control our own budget, needle exchange, you know, all the other laws that they can interfere with, ultimate control over our legal system. In fact, when I introduced you and said what is now the Attorney General's office, we have our first Attorney General ever, you know, elected Attorney General in the District of Columbia, the Attorney General's office. So there are many encumbrances, but I think that it's absolutely right that if you had two senators and a voting representative, all the other disparities would go away quickly.
Right.
Well, let me ask you, let's move on for a minute to statehood. We now have 223 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. You need 218 people to pass, representatives to pass the legislation in the House. We assume, although Mrs. Norton hasn't made it clear when we're going to have a markup, because the Congress seems to be consumed with other matters right now. But we expect that we will have a markup and this will pass in the House. Wouldn't you expect it to pass in the House?
I would. I do.
Yeah. And then when we get to the Senate, unfortunately, we only have 35 senators who are co-sponsors. I mean, not that that's not a lot. That's a lot of co-sponsors. But,
it is.
But you know, and I'm glad to say, I'm proud to say that my office worked with Menendez, Wyden, Feinstein, and Udall, who are all on the bill. So we're out there lobbying. We're getting people to sign on. We've also met with several Republicans. We've met with Tim Scott and Joni Ernst. But we can't get Republicans to move. It's become such a partisan issue. You know, we try to appeal to Joni Ernst because she's a veteran. And we said to her, this isn't about Democrats and Republicans. It's about 30,000 brave Americans who have served their country, Walter Smith being one of them. And that's what the issue is. And we said to Tim Scott, it's not about Democrats and Republicans. Our audience may know that Tim is an African-American. It's about 350,000 African-Americans that have been disenfranchised, not 1,000 in South Carolina, but 350,000. We don't seem to, you know, that they put up a wall and they seem to be standing firm behind it. Since you are, in fact, one of the top lawyers in Washington, Harvard-educated lawyer, do you have any insight on what we can do to break down that wall, to get one bravery. Johnny Barnes, who I know you know, who's another lawyer in town, always says, what we need is one brave Republican. How do we get that one brave Republican?
Well, I think you're more apt to get the one brave Republican, and it's a little bit of a catch-22, but the more visibility we bring to this inequity, the more that the constituents of Republican senators back home begin to see this issue and care about this issue, the more the Republican senators are apt to start supporting this. I mean, I agree with you. I don't think anyone could reasonably disagree that this shouldn't be about partisanship. This is about the rights of Americans, Americans who pay taxes and go to war and have to obey the laws, have all the responsibility for citizenship, but are denied the most basic right. Now, you and I know that, but until the Joni Ernsts of the world hear from her constituents back home who say, we care about this, this is an issue where we want you to put partisanship aside. If you can get one Republican senator to start hearing from constituents back home that those constituents want to see their senator supporting this, I think that's when this is going to turn. And I know you know that, and I know you're working on that issue. But I think that is one of the strategies we need to be pursuing.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I don't think we put enough money into it. You know, if you gave me an unlimited budget and sent me out there, that's the first thing I'd do. I'd go to Iowa and I'd put up billboards with pictures of National Guard men from the District of Columbia who have served in Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan and say, you know, these people deserve the same rights as everybody else. Because I never, Walter, and I know you talk about this all the time too, I never run into anybody that says, oh, no, you don't deserve the same rights that everybody else has, especially when it comes to veterans. I've never once had, I've even talked to Republican veterans who are against the idea of statehood because they follow the Republican, the talking points from the Republicans. But as soon as you sit down and talk to them and say, hey, look, we've got men and women here who have gone into to the face of danger in harm's way, and then they come back and they're treated differently than people who have never served. And they don't have the same rights. And almost unanimously, they agree, yes, that's wrong. Yes, it has to be resolved. And in fact, even the Republicans on Capitol Hill agree with that, but they always put up, what we generally refer to as a red herring. They say you have to amend the Constitution or you have to go through some extreme measure to make it happen, when we know that's not the case.
Well, just to go back to what I said a minute ago, that was what was so great about the breakthrough after the first lawsuit, when both houses of Congress agreed with us that a constitutional amendment is not required. So that's not a good argument any longer. And what's really nice about the current lawsuit, Senator, is that the Department of Justice is no longer arguing that it takes a constitutional amendment.
That was argued
in the first lawsuit. It's not being argued anymore. And so
that's
another reason why I feel good about where we are.
Yeah, I would say that that's a big step forward, because everybody knows that the Constitution has really only been amended 17 times, right? The first 10 amendments were like an addendum of things they forgot. And in that same period of time, we brought 37 states into the union. So it's obviously easier to become a state than it is to amend the Constitution. And the truth of the matter is, for our listeners, that we actually tried to do that. And we did get a constitutional amendment passed through both houses, but unfortunately it wasn't ratified by enough states. And again, in my humble opinion, it's because we didn't put enough money into it at the time. But let me ask you, now that you've told us so much about what you're doing in statehood, let me move a little bit and ask you, we've all been consumed with this impeachment hearing. I've got to tell you, I'm a long-term Democratic political type. I've been involved in Democratic politics, mostly at the national level, for 40 years. I've got a problem with it, and my problem is that I worry that we're going to impeach this man in the House because of the things he's done. He's going to go to the Senate. The Senate is going to not convict him. As if our listeners don't know, it's a two-step process where the House investigates and the Senate actually tries him. And at the end of the process, he's going to stand up and say, I've been vindicated. I went to court, right? They charged me. I went to court in the Senate, and the Senate said I was innocent. And it's just going to be one more thing to embolden the base. And I've got a really hard time understanding why we're not letting this just go to an election and doing everything we can to beat this man. Do you have any insight on that?
Well, I don't think we know where this is going to go. And given that the things I work on, like statehood and voting rights and the like, I would rather not discuss this in terms of the partisan effect of it.
Okay, I understand that.
Because I believe that people who live in the District of Columbia should have equal rights regardless of your view as a Democrat or Republican or an independent.
Right, and no, I understand
we'll see.
That.
We'll see how this plays out. I am a firm believer in the Constitution, and I understand why we're going through this process, and I respect the view of the Speaker, who has said at some point it was important, given the responsibility that the Congress has in the face of what some saw as impeachable offenses, to move forward on them.
Well, I understand that.
We'll
yeah.
see. We'll see how
yeah,
this
no,
plays out.
I absolutely understand that position that Speaker Pelosi has taken, I just believe, as Aristotle did, that everything is politics. So I look at everything from a political standpoint. But I understand that, and I understand why members of Congress would feel compelled under their obligation as a representative to pursue what they see as malfeasance on the part of the president. I truly understand that. Let me ask you, though, that since you are the executive director of DC Appleseed, and I used to run a public interest group called the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, so I know that we did work on all sorts of things, and I want to give you some time before the show ends. What other things are you working on that are important to you?
Well, quite a number of things, and one of them that we're working on right now is one of our longest-standing projects, and that is to be involved in the process to clean up the Anacostia River. As you know, the Anacostia was long thought to be one of the most polluted rivers in the nation.
Yeah,
we're now working to make it one of the cleanest rivers in the nation. We are in the middle of a process that involves the federal government, as well as a number of businesses locally and a number of environmental groups, to develop a plan for actually cleaning up the river. We've been in the middle of this for many years, and on the current calendar, we are supposed to see the proposed plan itself the end of next month, coming out of the director of the Department of Energy and the Environment here in the District of Columbia. And that process was put in place largely through the efforts of our group, who got the district council and the then mayor to adopt a process that we're in the middle of right now. So that's a very good thing, I think, for the city, and will ultimately not only help create a wonderful recreation destination for people in the city and the region, but will we end up being an engine also for economic development, potentially bringing more jobs and housing to people who live in the area. So that's one. I can mention several others if you want me to.
Well, let's stop on this one for just a second, because I agree with you 100%. I've said not only would I like to see the environment cleaned up, I think all of us would, those of us that still believe in things like global warming and pollution, but I also have for a long time said that Ward 8, which is the poorest, Ward 7 and 8, actually, which are the poorest parts of the city, which are separated in part by the Anacostia River, if we want to change those areas, if we want to bring development and prosperity to them, we have to give a reason. We have to give people a reason to go there. And I think if you cleaned up the river and made it a better recreational area, you would give a lot of people. In fact, I know I live in Northwest in Ward 3, and I know people that go down there now and get in sculls and do rowing on the Anacostia
right.
River. So
right.
I think if we could make it a better place, a better destination, that the benefits from it would far exceed a clean river. It would help a lot in economic development. So
right.
Thanks for doing that. So what else are you doing? What else
right.
is
well,
a
we
project
have,
that
for
you
a
love?
Long time, Senator, we have been involved in an effort to what we call reform the biggest health insurance company in the region, CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield. Because it is chartered by the Congress itself as a nonprofit, and working with a number of healthcare experts and actuarial experts, we've been arguing for quite some time that the company is not behaving as a true not-for-profit, but instead has built up what we call excessive surpluses. And we have won several rulings from the Insurance Commissioner and the Court of Appeals And I'm hoping that in the next several months we will either settle the matter with CareFirst or we will get a final ruling from the insurance commissioner. And we actually believe that the amount of money that's excessive in the company now is in the neighborhood of $300 million owed back just to the District of Columbia itself, which should be invested either in rebates to subscribers and or to help pay for community health care needs. And with that kind of money, there's a lot that CareFirst could be doing to better the lives of people who live in Washington, D.C. We've been fighting this battle for well over 10 years, and we just won another victory in August of this year from the Court of Appeals. So I'm hoping that since we like to be in things for the long run, but we like to see them end also, that we're going to get a final ruling sometime in the next several months and make all the work we put into it be worth it.
Well, thank you for that, because on this issue, you're really preaching to the choir. Blue Cross Blue Shield was my insurance company. I ran my own business for 25 years. The premiums for just my family, and this was, my business ended 10 years ago. The premiums went from $350 a month for family coverage over about 15 years up to $2,500 a month. It was the most expensive payment. It was twice what the mortgage on my house was, and actually pushed my wife into a brand new career where she went back to graduate school, became a librarian, but she first took a job with the school library because they couldn't pay her very much, but they could give her health benefits. And it was such a big thing for us to have health insurance and not have to pay these ridiculous premiums. So whatever you can do to Blue Cross Blue Shield, I will be the first one to stand up and cheer for that, because I think you're right. I think they do have excessive premiums. Do we have a caller on the line? I think we have a caller on the line. Do you have a question?
This is Denise Jason, and I just wanted to talk to Mr. To your guest in regard to Appleseed's position some time ago on the school board. I think they had something to do with taking it out, and that was our first Democratic body.
Okay, I don't know. Did you understand that, Walter, that question?
I didn't. Maybe she can say that again.
Yes. I remember when there was a debate over the school board, and I believe Appleseed voted to eliminate that, and it was one of our first Democratic institutions was the D.C. school board.
This may have been before my time, I'm sorry to say. All of my efforts since I've been here, and I just celebrated my 18th year, so I've been at this a while. But everything that we've been involved in since I have come has been designed to advance democracy for the city. And I'll just mention two of them. One of them, the senator mentioned a minute ago, we were quite instrumental in allowing the city to vote for its attorney general. We authored the referendum that was on the ballot, and we went to court to defend the choice of the citizens to elect their attorney general. We also were one of the prime movers behind the budget autonomy referendum.
Okay.
And we actually had to go to court to defend that as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I am a strong believer in greater democracy for D.C. Mm-hmm. residents. I think we should have as much democracy as anybody else.
Absolutely.
And so anything that takes away from that, at least as long as I'm the director here, I don't want to support.
Okay. Your lawsuit, is it for statehood or is it for voting rights?
I'm for both. As the senator and I discussed a minute ago, those two efforts work together. And I think they complement one another. I think we should go after both of them simultaneously, which is what we're doing. If the statehood bill passes before we win this lawsuit, I'm happy to have the statehood bill moot out the lawsuit. But if we win the lawsuit before the statehood bill passes, I think that getting voting representation will help ensure statehood. So I think it's good to be fighting for both of them.
Okay. Well, I would just add to that,
whereas I stood against in theory, the D.C. Voting Rights Act, because I thought one vote in the House of Representatives might stop our effort for statehood. I think if you get both votes in both houses, I'd be happy. If you get senators and if that's what voting rights is, two senators and a voting representative, then I'm for it.
Okay. Well, I was wondering about that because the Constitution says you must be a state to have representation in the House and the Senate.
Well, that's a very wonderful question. What about that, Walter? What if
the answer to that is that under the district clause that we discussed a minute ago, the Congress has the authority to give us full voting representation in the House and the Senate, even though we are not a state. And as our lawsuit points out, there are other situations in which Congress has conferred the vote on people who don't live in a state, showing that they have the power to do that when they want to do that. And the best example of that is, and you probably are familiar with this, many years ago, people who once lived in states and moved overseas complained about the fact that the states that they moved from wouldn't let them vote anymore. And the Congress passed a law saying, no, people who once lived in the state and who move overseas are entitled to continue to vote. So we say that just shows you that the Constitution doesn't limit voting representation only to people who currently live in states. And, of course, people who live in the District of Columbia, their ancestors also once lived in a state. And we say that Congress should exercise its authority under the district clause at long last to restore our right to vote.
Well, and you know what? We say that all the time, that you can move to Paris or you can move to London or you can move to Rome and you don't lose your right to vote. The only place you can move and lose your right to vote is Washington, D.C. So we're always saying that. Well, Walter Smith, before I let you go, I have to talk about your highest accolade, which I've discovered. You're not only a Harvard-educated lawyer and one of the greatest lawyers one of the greatest 90 lawyers in Washington, D.C., you're also the junior hula hoop champion of Oklahoma. Is that true?
That is true.
Can you explain to me, first of all, how a man with no hips gets to be a hula hoop champion?
Well, you don't have to have hips to make the hoop go around. You just have to know how to move your hips.
Well, obviously you know how to move your hips. And I've been to Oklahoma many times, and I can tell you, there's plenty of hip movers in Oklahoma, so that's quite a distinguished award you've received, and I will never, ever, ever look at you the same. But thank you so much for being on our show. We very much appreciate it. Thank you, caller, for calling in and asking those wonderful questions. And Maria, we'll see you all next week. Thank you, Walter. We always play a song when we leave, usually in honor of our guests. So tonight, here's a classic from Nina Simone called I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. Thank you so much, Walter Smith.
Thank you for having me. Good night.
Good night.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things.
Give the people their right to vote.